Dobry wieczór Państwu. Mam nadzieję, że wszyscy wzięli już słuchawki, ci, którzy ich potrzebowali. Ja nazywam się Dariusz Stola, jestem dyrektorem Muzeum Historii Żydów Polskich, Muzeum POLIN. Dzisiaj mam przyjemność powitać Państwa na wykładzie wybitnej izraelskiej historyczki, pani profesor Anity Shapiro, wieloletniej wykładowczyni Uniwersytetu Tel Awiwskiego, obecnie to profesor emerita. Jest to wiodący autorytet, jeśli chodzi o najnowszą historię Izraela, historię nowoczesną. W szczególności jest najbardziej autorytatywną osobą, jeśli chodzi o postać Ben-Guriona, twórcy, ojca założyciela państwa Izrael. I więc będą mogli Państwo słyszeć tą historię z najbardziej autorytatywnych ust. Dodam tylko, że dwie jej książki, jedna, która dotyczy historii Izraela do 2000 roku, jeśli dobrze pamiętam, i druga nazywa się Ben-Gurion i właśnie dotyczy tej postaci, mają się wkrótce ukazać w tłumaczeniu na język polski. Także w samą porę nasz wykład przypada, może Państwa zachęci do pogłębionej lektury jej prac. A teraz oddaję już głos pani profesor Anicie Shapiro. Please, the floor is yours.
Professor Stola, friends, colleagues, my grandson Nadav, it's a pleasure to be here today with you. I was born in this city, but I don't know Polish, and you'll have to excuse me that I even don't congratulate you in Polish, because it would be a sin against the Polish language. So let me say a few words before I start with my lecture about connections between Israeli culture and Polish culture, Israel and Poland. First of all, demography. Do you know that in the Jewish community in Palestine, pre-statehood, the majority were Jews from Poland? Yes, yes, they were the majority, simply for the reason that when in the 20s the Soviet Union was closed, the greatest source of people that came to Palestine was Poland. So you are going to ask me, what about Germany? Well, from Germany there came maybe 50,000 people, but in the Yishuv in Palestine on the eve of statehood, there were 650,000 Jews. Where did they come from? Most of them came from Poland. Number one. Number two, where from comes political Israeli culture? So I would say there are two cultures. The pioneering culture that was inspired by Russian revolutionary culture, and the bourgeois culture that was inspired by Polish culture. So to this day, the Israeli culture of Tel Aviv is influenced by Polish culture. When I did not know until I came to visit Poland in 86, why Bank Leumi is called Bank Leumi, Narodowy Bank, and Narodowy Theater, and so and so and so. Everything is Narodowy. So you should know that this is the direct influence from Poland. And last but not least, did you realize that out of five prime ministers that were not born in Israel, four were born in Poland? Ben-Gurion, Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, Shimon Peres, all of them were born in this country. So yes, we have Polish roots, Polish Jewish roots, and let's not forget it. And now, after this introduction, I'm going to speak about the man who changed history, David Ben-Gurion. David Ben-Gurion died in December 1973. Israel was suffering the shock of the Yom Kippur War, mourning its fall, and fearful about the future. People paid scant attention to the passing of the founding father, the man who had taken Jewish history by storm and established the Jewish state. It was a low-key ending to a turbulent life, rich with expected and unexpected points. Okay. Ben-Gurion chose to be buried not on Mount Herzl, the national mausoleum he himself had created. Do you hear me? Okay. Intended for the leaders of the state where Theodor Herzl lies, but atop a high cliff overlooking Wadi Tzin and the Negev Desert. He asked that his gravestone be inscribed with only the dates of his birth and death, and the words, "immigrated to the land of Israel in 1906. Nothing more. Do his choice of his burial place, not along the nation's graves, and the self-effacing inscription attest to humility in the face of death? Ben-Gurion was a man of simple manners, dressed simply, lived modestly, who was accessible to every man and woman, who corresponded with thousands of citizens and mingled with the public without fear or restraint. At the same time, he was fully aware of his worth and knew his historical importance. But in Jewish tradition, there is an accepted titular hierarchy. Rabbi is higher than Rav. Rabban is higher than Rabbi. But highest of all is the one whose untitled name is sufficient. Ben-Gurion, in Hebrew we say, Gadol mi Rabban Shmo. Ben-Gurion chose for himself a unique commemorative site, far from the National Mausoleum, so that people would make a pilgrimage to his grave and his alone. Non-mention of his deeds on the gravestone intended to say, his name is sufficient, and the rest will be told in the history of Israel. There are leaders regarding whom it was clear since their early youth that they were destined for greatness. This was not the case with Ben-Gurion. He was born in a small town to a humble family, which teetered between modest comfort and poverty, which trod the fine line between tradition and modernity, and could not afford to send its children to acquire a high school education. The start of Ben-Gurion's journey into the big world was inauspicious. Unlike Dr. Theodor Herzl or Dr. Chaim Weizmann, who came from middle-class families, had a university degree, and acquired a profession that ensured their livelihood without having to be dependent on the Zionist organization. Ben-Gurion did not have a life outside politics. He did not study and had no profession. Before discovering political activity, he was a young man without a purpose. When he did discover it, during the first Russian Revolution in 1905, his life was suddenly given a direction, a purpose, and meaning. He would mention two books that directed him on the two major avenues of his life, Zionism and socialism. The first Hebrew novel, Abraham Mappo, Ahavat Zion, The Love of Zion, and Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. It is difficult to ascertain whether this presentation of his conversion was late realization or actually reflected the reality. If the latter, it reflected the naivety of a small town boy, not exposed to the more sophisticated writings of either Zionism or socialism. He read the great Russian novels of the 19th century, modern Hebrew literature and poetry, and admired poets Bialik and Chernyakhovsky. Yet, he was always drawn more to philosophy, and early on discovered Nietzsche and the vitalistic concepts popular at the turn of the century in their Hebrew version. Since his adolescence, his great love was reserved for Plato and Spinoza, whose works he admired all his life. In the last 40 years of his life, he read very little fine literature, but a great deal on philosophy, Jewish studies, history, political science, and political thought. Since the 1950s, he was fascinated by Buddhism, all of Israel's legacies were were employed in buying books for him. In his will, he bequeathed his library, which contained more than 18,000 books and thousands of booklets, to the state. As prime minister, he saw himself not only as being responsible for the state's political and military well-being, but also for fostering culture. In 1950, a year of mass immigration to Israel, when the economy tottered under the pressure, he found the means to initiate the microfilming of Hebrew manuscripts from all over the world and bringing them to Israel, which he described as ingathering those exiles of the spirit of Israel dispersed in the diaspora. These microfilms became the basis of the archives of the Jewish people in Jerusalem. He later initiated another vast enterprise, translating all of humankind's spiritual treasures into Hebrew, from Europe, America, and Asia, which was done under the auspices of a very respectable committee in which professors Martin Buber and Hugo Bergman took part. He also found the time to participate in the meetings of this committee, but did not dictate its choices. By the way, the first book that he recommended was Darwin's The Origin of Species. He was fascinated by the idea of bringing into the new state all the finest products of humanity, and did not shy away when religious Jews reproached him for claiming that Israel has a lot to learn from non-Jewish thinkers. During his years in office, four new universities were established, and the three older institutions of higher learning were further developed, despite economic dire straits. His idea of Israel as a light unto the nations meant, among other things, the development of study and science. He did not feel inferior to the professors with whom he conducted an ongoing discussion on Plato, Spinoza, the Bible, Indian philosophy, ethics. Since the early days of statehood, he initiated an ongoing dialogue with Israel's leading scholars. He loved intellectual cut and thrust, and it seemed that sometimes he viewed it as a refuge from the monotony of political routine. On the other hand, he had scant respect for experts. They are experts on what had happened in the past, not on what will be in the future. He retorted when rejecting their recommendations. When a committee of experts which he had appointed determined that there was no possibility of building a modern city in Beersheba, his director general questioned, "What are we going to do now?" "Well," said Ben Gurion, "we will appoint a new committee." Ben Gurion was not born Ben Gurion. He underwent a long apprenticeship before blazing his trail into public consciousness, first of the Jewish Yeshuv, Jewish community in Palestine, then the World Zionist Organization and the Jewish people, and only later of the entire world. The first time he appeared on the front page of a journal, not in Hebrew or in Yiddish, was in 1949. During the period of Ottoman rule, despite being involved in Zionist socialist activity in Palestine, he did not leave his mark. It was only after his return to Palestine from his exile in the United States during World War I that he began to gain prominence in his political activity when he was already in his mid-30s. He served as Secretary General of the Histadrut Labor Federation for 15 years. In those years, he was a militant workers' leader who did not flinch from confrontation with employers or rival workers' organizations, such as a rightist revisionist organization. In 1933, Ben-Gurion made one of the most important decisions of his life. He embarked on an election campaign with the aim of gaining hegemony in the Zionist movement for the worker movements. Two political streams, which both appealed to the Jewish masses, mainly in Poland, were in the ascendancy. Labor and the right-wing revisionists led by Vladimir Jabotinsky. The question was, who would win the majority in the next Zionist Congress? It was against this backdrop that a dramatic election campaign was held in Poland, where there were millions of Jews, the largest source of potential voters to the Congress. It was there that for the first time, a typical Ben-Gurion mode of operation came to the fore. He identified the objective, defined the tools for achieving it, and then went into action with all the force he could muster. The objective this time was a workers' majority in the election in Eastern Europe. The tool, enlisting the members of the Zionist youth movements. By the way, in the museum, you don't mention that these are Zionist youth movements. You should change it. Enthusiastic, energetic young volunteers instead of the older and tired party activists. In addition, for 3 months, he crisscrossed Poland, Galicia, and the Baltic states, speaking in a different town each day, meeting with the young people, checking their list of shekel sales, which means the vote tax for the Zionist Congress, urging, encouraging, reprimanding, and supporting them. In the end, he achieved 44% of the votes to the Congress, almost a majority. Thus began labor hegemony that lasted until 1977. That was a transitional moment in Ben-Gurion's career, from workers' leader to Zionist leader. He was still immature, still prepared to clash with the revisionists in street fights in Tel Aviv. But he was gradually exposed to the more important things. He was elected chairman of the Jewish Agency political department and discovered the world of diplomacy as he held talks with the British High Commissioner, Sir Arthur Wacob. Despite his long-winded speeches, which tried Wacob's patience, he impressed him. He attempted to negotiate with the Arabs of Palestine and was not discouraged by his failures. He was still sufficiently inexperienced to believe that if he were sincere and honest, and offered the Arabs development, modernization, and parity in government, they would agree to Jewish immigration. But after 2 years of futile attempts, he realized that in the best case, they would agree for the Jews to be a small minority in Palestine. Whereas he was not prepared to relinquish the dream of a Jewish state. This, too, was part of Ben-Gurion's apprenticeship, understanding that he could not achieve everything he wanted. In 1937, a proposal to partition Palestine into a Jewish and an Arab state was first tabled. The proposal came from the British Royal Commission of Inquiry, headed by Lord Peel, which visited Palestine in the wake of the Arab revolt, which erupted in 1936. It was the first time that a concrete proposal had been made regarding the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine, small but independent. Ben-Gurion viewed it as an extraordinary opportunity, a seminal moment in the long history of the Jewish people. Completely agitated, he could not sleep at night. In the end, the British abandoned the plan and adopted an anti-Zionist policy instead. But from that time on, Ben-Gurion saw the idea of partition as the right compromise with the Arabs, which would enable the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. It seems that leaders have a time or mission predestined in history. Thus, in the 1930s, Churchill was considered a failed leader who switched parties several times, was on the margins of political activity, and with his belligerent stance against Hitler, appeared to be a warmonger. Then the picture changed with the outbreak of the World War, and Churchill became perhaps the most important leader in the 20th century. De Gaulle fulfilled a historic mission during World War II when he formed the Free French Forces that fought the Vichy regime. After the war, he was sent into the political wilderness until he was called to save France again, from this time from the Algerian War in 58. Ben-Gurion, too, had his moment in history. 1941 saw the beginning of the decade, which I call Ben-Gurion's magnificent decade. In those years, he envisaged the establishment of the state and that it would involve war against the Arab countries, prepared the tools to cope with this eventuality, directed the War of Independence, Israel's bitterest war, decided on mass immigration that within 3 years doubled Israel's population, and transferred the capital to Jerusalem despite the United Nations decision on internationalization. This in addition to his decision to move Israel to the Western Camp, to initiate the reparations agreements with Germany, etc., etc., etc. That decade began with his 1941 trip to the United States, where he arrived completely unknown. No one awaited him at the port, and an immigration officer could not comprehend why this Jew from Palestine had come to the United States, and he was detained for a few days. But a few months later, he already formulated the Zionist plan of action for the wartime period. The Zionists' war objective was the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. Enlisting American support for that goal was imperative. But the American State Department supported the British Foreign Office's anti-Zionist positions. While President Roosevelt was not anti-Zionist, he thought that Palestine was too small to solve the problem of millions of Jews. He did not know that they almost perished by that time. Ben-Gurion asserted that it was essential to change Roosevelt's position. And in order to do that, American Jewry had to be organized as a pressure group that would exert its influence on intellectuals, labor union leaders, and churches. Once public opinion supported the idea of a Jewish state, the president would be compelled to follow through. The road, I quote, "The road to the White House passes through the American people," he declared. The question was how to do it. The Jews of America that had entered the war only in December 1941, following the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, were apprehensive lest the war be labeled as a Jewish war, and objected to any action that might hurt the president. They would change their position once the scope of the Holocaust became known. At this stage, Ben-Gurion's attempts to form a united front of American Jewry ended in failure, but the direction had been set out. The Biltmore Conference of American Zionists in April 1942 declared that the Jewish people's war objective was the establishment of a state in Palestine. For Ben-Gurion, this constituted a plan of action. No one knew when a state would be established. The British were determined to keep their anti-Zionist policy. And after the war, with the rise in Britain of the Labour Party to power, they even hardened this line. They had no intention of leaving Palestine. Nevertheless, Ben-Gurion was convinced that the state would be established soon, and his establishment would involve war with the Arabs. In the summer of 1945, while the war with Japan still went on, he took a step which he later viewed as one of the three most important things he had done in his life. The other two being his immigration to Palestine in 1906 and the proclamation of Israel's independence in 48. In New York, he convened a meeting of several dozens wealthy Jews from all over America. In a day-long seminar, he explained to them that a Jewish state would indeed be established soon and that a war would ensue, not only against the local Arabs, but against the Arab states. At that time, neither the Arabs nor the Jews, I imagined that the British would leave Palestine, not to mention an invasion by the Arab states. The Jews could win, he declared, but they needed arms. In America, the sale of military surplus for scrap had begun, and equipment for a military industry in Palestine could be purchased at a very low cost. Ben-Gurion asked those present to set up a special fund for this procurement. All of those present agreed, and the Sonborn Foundation, named after the man in whose house the meeting was held, was created. The machines purchased were shipped to Palestine, dismantled and camouflaged as spare parts and agricultural machinery, and then reassembled. This machinery was the foundation stone of the Israel military industries. After the Second World War, the Jewish people was at its nadir. 6 million Jews had perished. In Palestine, the British ruled with an iron fist and prevented Jewish refugees from entering the country. Ben-Gurion learned how to turn weakness into strength. He identified the assets at his disposal. The Yishuv, which was prepared to fight the British, the Jewish community in America, which would exert political pressure on the president, and the Jewish refugees from Eastern Europe, mostly from Poland, in the displaced persons camps in Germany, who would not allow the problem of Palestine to be removed from the international agenda. He activated three channels of action. In Palestine, the Jewish resistance movement was formed, which sabotaged British facilities in order to demonstrate that they would be unable to rule the country without an agreement with the Jews. In America, Rabbi Hillel Silver turned the Jewish minority into an ethnic pressure group whose weight began to be felt in American politics. And in Germany, Ben-Gurion visited the displaced persons' camps, the only Jewish leader to do so, where he met with the Jewish refugees. A very moving description exists of the meeting by the chief rabbi of the American army, called Rabbi Bernstein, if I remember correctly. Ben-Gurion came with him to Bergen-Belsen very early on, and as soon as he entered the camp, people started to recognize the white mane of hair that was his trading mark and started to chant, Ben-Gurion, Ben-Gurion. So the rabbi told them, he's going to speak to you. So they came to a hall, all of them concentrated in a big hall, and Ben-Gurion came to the stage. And everybody in the hall started singing Hatikva spontaneously. And then Ben-Gurion wanted to talk. He started in Yiddish, Teire Brüder und Schwester, dear brothers and sisters. But then his voice broke, his throat choked, and he started crying, and the whole hall cried with him. Ben-Gurion raised their spirits and assured them that they would soon immigrate to Palestine. The illegal immigration he organized, which the British tried to halt, kept the subject on the international agenda, much to the frustration of the British, who hoped that the refugees would despair and return to their countries of origin. These two pressures led the British to take the question of Palestine to the United Nations in February 1947. The rest is history. It seems to us today that the decision on the establishment of the state on May 12, 1948 was self-evident, but that was not how it seemed at the time. Taking such a decision, when U.S. Secretary of State General George Marshall cautioned the Jews about defeat in the war, he said, "Don't listen to victory intoxicated generals. You are going to lose, and we are not going to bail you out." When the Haganah chief of staff was reporting that the chances of victory were no more than 50-50%, and while the Americans were demanding that the decision be postponed for a few months, taking a decision was no easy thing. It was only Ben-Gurion's powers of persuasion that led to a 6-4 majority in the provisional government in favor of independence. The decision was carried by one vote. A few years ago, I participated in a panel in London on independence, on a decision to take in, on independence. And after I presented the story, the mediator asked me, what would Ben-Gurion do had the majority gone to the other side? And I instinctively answered, he would have made them change their mind. And I think it's right. He would not have come out of that room without a positive decision, because he understood there is no such thing as a vacuum in politics. If the British had gone, if the British are out, somebody has got to make the decision. But it was not easy. 3 years after the end of the World War, after the Holocaust, he took a gamble on the great hope of the Jewish people, the state. He was fully aware of the risks. He was very apprehensive. But as Golda Meir said, he was capable of making difficult decisions, not because he was not afraid, but despite his being afraid. Could anyone else have taken such a decision that meant sending thousands of young men to their death? There had been no precedent for this in Jewish history since the Bar Kokhba revolt in the second century. After the war, another big question faced Prime Minister Ben-Gurion. How does one educate a nation that for 2,000 years had not had political rule to accept authority and majority rule? Ben-Gurion was very apprehensive of the Jewish people's anarchistic inclinations, its tendency toward dissension on hair splitting, its lack of governmental tradition. It was against this backdrop that the Alta Lena affair erupted, the Etzel's armed vessel that Ben-Gurion ordered to be sunk because he viewed it as a challenge to the army's authority, the state's authority. This decision drew sharp criticism. How could Jews fight against Jews? But it also set out ground rules that were fully observed throughout Ben-Gurion's terms of office. In recent decades, we witness in Israel minority groups challenging the authority of the state, sometimes successfully. Fortunately, Ben-Gurion's statist legacy still holds firm and is accepted by one and all. On the eve of the establishment of the state, in order to grant broad public legitimacy to the nascent state, he formulated the status quo agreement with the religious parties, giving them authority over marital laws, and he even spoke of preserving the Jewish character of the state in the public sphere. He believed that the ultra-Orthodox Jews would soon disappear, which did not happen. Nevertheless, he scrupulously avoided a total crisis with the religious circles. He crossed swords ideologically with religious politicians and intellectuals, but avoided rupture. during the nation's formative period, he explained, it was essential to avoid schism among the people. I wonder what he would have to say on this subject today. Ben-Gurion viewed the 1949 borders as sufficient territory for the absorption of all the Jews desiring to come to Israel. He rejected demands of young generals to extend the country's borders. We don't need more territory, he stated. We need more Jews. He adhered to this view even after the Six-Day War in 67, when he stated that all the occupied territories, with the exception of Jerusalem and the Golan Heights, should be returned in exchange for peace. Despite his disparaging remarks about the United Nations, the famous Shmum, he was extremely attentive to world opinion. Throughout his life, he sought a close relationship with the United States, the great democratic power. But America of the 1950s turned its back on the young state. And while the Arab countries were supported by the Soviet Union, America refused to supply Israel with arms or give it international support. To his dying day, Ben-Gurion was never an official guest of the White House. The state's early years were years of revolution. Within 3 years, the population doubled in size and had to be provided with housing, work, and education. The mission of forming a nation out of people from dozens of countries who spoke different languages and who came from a wide range of traditions and culture was, in Ben-Gurion's eyes, a mission of paramount importance, the true Zionist revolution. But unlike political objectives, which he not only knew how to define, but also to find the levers for their attainment, the objective of forming a nation was more elusive and harder to implement. His attempts in this direction did not gain success to the degree he hoped for. He was not prepared to listen to his advisor, who demanded that immigration be restricted, since the state was unable to shoulder the burden of immigrant absorption. He was not prepared to hear about selection. Every Jew here can be educated and reach the same cultural level as the veteran members of the Yishuv. But he was impatient and did not understand that cultural integration takes longer than forming an army or directing a war. In the end, Ben-Gurion was disappointed with the state he had founded. The chosen people, or a light unto the nations, the slogans he used to voice, did not express reality, but rather an aspiration toward betterment of the state and the creation of a utopian society. It is yet to come into being. Ben-Gurion used to say that he did not do what the people wanted, but what he thought they needed. This was paternalism, which drew criticism at the time, but certainly would today. But it reflected his willingness to take responsibility and make difficult decisions, which in retrospect proved correct. Again, Golda Meir said, every time I opposed him, it turned out in the end that he was right. He possessed a sense of historic opportunity that guided him through his most difficult times. And first and foremost, he had the courage to take calculated risks. Ben-Gurion held that history is not made by leaders, but by the masses, by spontaneous processes. But he would add, at fateful moments, a courageous, resolute leader capable of making hard decisions makes the difference between victory and defeat. He was referring to Churchill, but by the same token, his words are true of himself. Would Ben-Gurion have been able to cope with the complex reality of the 21st century, of an open, almost anarchic society with a variety of diffused foci of authority? Would he have succeeded in dealing with present-day media, or would the bloggers joke at the slogan he liked to voice, which were indeed pompous, if one did not believe in his sincerity? And within a few days, they would shatter his authority. After the establishment of the state, the aura of the founding father, the victor of the war of independence, accorded him almost messianic status among the new immigrants. But even then, members of his party and of the opposition had no qualms in undermining his authority, and in the end, caused his exit from the political stage. And here we come to a difficult questions about leaders. When should a leader quit, if not die? Dying is even better than quitting. Herzl died, he was 44. He remained in our memory young and full of vigor and a successful leader. Now, think of those leaders like Churchill or De Gaulle that lived to old age and had to be ousted from office. They all died poor and depressed and pathetic. And the same was with Ben-Gurion. But he bequeathed to the state of Israel and the Jewish people a model of a leader who combined political wisdom with military daring, caution with the ability to make difficult decisions, responsibility for shaping a nation and national culture. When the Camp David negotiations in 2000 between Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat collapsed, one of the Palestinians remarked, "We needed a Ben-Gurion, but we have got Arafat." At present, in a time of leadership that shies away from making difficult decisions and submits to pressure, a leadership that every day examines its image in the public opinion polls that change with the latest television news, we yearn for a Ben-Gurion. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this excellent lecture. We have some time for questions. I think you may use the headsets at this moment. Proszę Państwa, mamy trochę czasu na pytania do Pani Profesor. Tu koledzy, nasi wolontariusze będą mieli mikrofon, także kto z Państwa chciałby zadać pytanie, proszę podnieść rękę i podamy mikrofon.
Raise your voice.
Tam już widzę jedna osoba, druga po lewej stronie. Może oddam od razu mikrofon, żeby było łatwiej.
Two quick questions. First, I'm referring to the story that Shimon Peres apparently said to David Laudner. And he mentioned that in 1923, when Ben-Gurion went to Moscow for the agriculture exhibition,
yes,
he was extremely disappointed with the Soviet system. And he wrote in his memoirs, I think, or in a letter to a family, that the country that was promoting socialism worldwide was in fact a dictatorship that crumbled its own society and basically was an authoritarian state. On the other hand, he was an admirer of Lenin. He dressed like a revolutionary. He apparently bought some 60 books on Russian trade unions and on revolution during his stay in Moscow. And he also boasted to Shimon Peres that he read the entire readings of Lenin, 40 volumes or so.
I believe it.
What kind of contradiction was that in his personality? What were his views on communism, socialism, whatever it is, and did that change in time? Second question is relating to the current discussion of historians, some historians in Israel about Ben-Gurion in about 1948 with respect to what happened to the Arab population in Palestine. The official Israeli history claims that the Arabs fled because their leaders told them to run so that when the Arab armies win the war, they will come back to their villages. And that was the official history in Israel, and apparently, as some historians, revisionist historians, Israeli historians are saying, that this is not an entirely true story, and that this history was fabricated with the knowledge of Ben-Gurion or at his order, it's not clear, and this is challenged, and the consensus seems to be shifting towards the view that, well, some fled because they were told by their leaders to flee. Others, and most of them, ran because they were scared, and some were simply expelled, and there were some war crimes as well, etc., etc. Is there such a debate in Israel, and what's your view? And in particular, do the Israeli public at large care about this? Yeah, because Ben-Gurion remains number one Israeli politician and great figure, but do people care about such dents or scars in his image?
Okay. Thank you for two very interesting questions. The first one, Ben-Gurion in the early 20s, like the whole Jewish community in Palestine, admired the Soviet Union from afar. The visit to Moscow and buying and coming into direct contact with Soviet reality, I would say, tarred the image of the Soviet Union in his eyes. He admired Lenin, I would say, at least until 1928. Lenin was for him a model of a leader that was capable of taking the opportunity that history put in front of him and make use of it. Now, Ben-Gurion had the mentality of a revolutionary that reality frustrated him. Reality put all the time the brakes on him. And as a result, all his life story is, in a way, a story of a frustrated revolutionary that does not reach the aims that he would like to, the goals that he envisions. So this is the first question. The second question. Israel is a democratic country with all the limits that exist in democratic countries. I don't know of an official history. There was a version of history that was written by certain non-professional historians, journalists, politicians, army commanders, but no such thing as an official history. Now, the fact that some of the 700,000 Palestinians that left the country, some of them left of their own will, some of them fled, some of them were expelled, and some of them were killed, this is a fact that is accepted by all historians in Israel. And if there was a debate on this question, I would say it was a debate in the later 80s or early 90s. Today, it's no state secret anymore. But for some reason, and I wrote about it, people always prefer not to remember the things that they don't like about their past. This is a fact of life everywhere. Do you agree? So Israelis also joined the club. So here we are. Okay.
Good evening, Professor. Here I am. My name is Michał Przybylak. I'm Warsaw War University in Rembertów. You have a cell phone and headphone, so I can speak Polish. Yes, someone translate.
I don't understand. I understand here everywhere, there everywhere, but not everything.
It's okay.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Can I speak Polish? Someone translate it? Yes. Jestem żołnierzem, więc krótkie dwa żołnierskie pytania. Pierwsze. Co Ben-Gurion myślał o młodym, odrodzonym izraelskim wojsku? Jakie stosunki?
I don't hear you.
Proszę mówić, ja przetłumaczę na angielski. Proszę poczekać.
What about the IDF?
So the first question is, what did Ben-Gurion think about the new reborn Israeli army? And these are the questions are coming from a soldier, because the gentleman is a soldier.
Okay.
And the second question?
I can speak English,
please.
So I think that Polish in Poland, yeah. Never mind. What Ben-Gurion think about especially Israel soldiers, about Arik Sharon?
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. First of all, Ben-Gurion was enamored with the young army, with the young soldiers, more than any other politician that I remember in Israel. He treated them, I would say, as a grandfather, but also as their commander. Now, you have to understand that in 46, when Ben-Gurion invented the portfolio of security minister of the Zionist movement, he took half a year to study the military situation of the Jewish population in Palestine. And he came to very dismal conclusions. There was no army, there was only a militia, this militia was thinking at most about small combat units, and the third thing, they were trained in guerrilla fighting and not against regular armies. So Ben Gurion had to change the concept of the army completely. First of all, he had to redefine the enemy because they were fighting the British, not the Arabs. Second, he had to change the army from a militia to a regular army. Third, he had to change their concept of size. They were speaking about light weapons. He was speaking about tanks airplanes and so on and so forth. And the members of the army, the commanders of the armies, would mumble, "The old man had gone crazy." And this is a fact. So Ben-Gurion really built the army from scratch, and he made it into the army who won the War of Independence. Now, regarding Arik Sharon, he had a soft spot for Arik Sharon. Arik Sharon was a bad boy, even in the Sinai campaign. He did not obey orders, but he was a brilliant general, and Ben-Gurion had a soft spot for him. So after being, I would say, half sent into pension by the army, when he appointed Yitzhak Rabin on the eve of his own retirement, he asked Rabin to reinstate Arik Sharon. And Rabin told me the following story, that Arik Sharon, that he called Arik Sharon to an interview with him and told him, "I am going to send you to this and this general's office. And for a whole year, I don't want to hear one complaint about you." And Rabin remarked, and this was the only year in which Sharon did not attempt to oust his commander. So this was the story of Arik Sharon.
Good evening, Professor. I have two questions here. I have two questions. You spoke about David Ben-Gurion somehow comparing him to people like De Gaulle or Winston Churchill, who are democratic leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But while listening to some of your remarks, some of your points, I was beginning to feel that maybe you would like to compare him to somebody else, like, I don't know, like Atatürk, who was a great leader, certainly not a democratic person. So the first question is, was David Ben-Gurion a democratic leader? What did he think about democracy?
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea of what might be the answer, but still. And the second question is, what did David Ben-Gurion think about religion, especially in the Jewish-Israeli context, about, you know, relations, states, synagogue, and so on? Thank you.
Okay. First of all, you ask whether Ben-Gurion was a democratic leader. Yes, he was a democratic leader because he left a democratic state. He left behind a democratic state. He did not leave Turkey as Ataturk left it, with the army every now and then taking control. And he always obeyed the decision of the majority. He worked hard to have the majority, but he always accepted the decisions of the majority, even when he was not happy with them. If you ask me if he was a liberal leader, this is a different question. This, I am not sure that he would be the right person for this rubric. Because at that time, he compared himself not to present-day democracy, liberal democracy, but he compared himself to the leading leaders of his own time. Now, was the goal a democratic leader? I'm not sure. Was a Churchill a democratic leader according to present-day norms? I'm not sure about it. He was a democratic leader according to the norms of democratic leadership of his time, not of today. And history changes. How would he react today? I don't know. I don't know. I believe that he would change with time, but I cannot swear to it. I am not a prophet. Now, the other question you asked, the religion. He was not religious, not in any way. Now, today there is a trend in Israel to add a kippah to the fathers of Zionism. So suddenly, Vladimir Jabotinsky, who would be very surprised, appears to have almost a beard. And Herzl, of course. So people are also looking for Ben-Gurion's religious roots. Ben-Gurion, like all his generation, especially those who came from small towns, came from a traditional home. And he was very well versed in Jewish tradition. Nevertheless, he believed that Israel should be a secular country. And he would not accept, in this regard, any compromise with the religious parties. The question of the marital laws, which is bogging us to this very day, in his times, this did not seem such a terrible question as it seems today. Because at those times, in the 50s, the religious parties and the religious establishment were much more lenient than they are today. They changed. They changed. Because what we see is growing extremism from the religious side. And somebody like Ben-Gurion, who could compromise with them, he would have 400 yeshiva bochers because he wanted them to symbolize the Jewish culture that vanished in Poland, etc. But he was sure that this is a remnant that would pass with history. And what we see today, we see a community with 20,000 or more yeshiva bochers, And we see in the religious Zionist parties a growing extremism. For instance, in the 50s or 60s, B'nai Akiva, boys and girls, would be together. Girls would come with short sleeves. And today you would not see it. Today they have a problem to listen to girls singing. Goodness, where are we? So how could Ben-Gurion imagine what's going to happen? He was sure, as all that generation, that the direction of history was going against religion. The fact that people went back to religion, not only in Israel, in the United States as well, and in the Islamic world as well. This does not mean that Ben-Gurion could have foreseen this strange development.
My question is, my question is, we heard a lot about his successes. What would you think was his biggest or big mistake in his...
I don't hear.
Do you hear now?
Maybe you get up.
Now, do you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. My question is like that. What do you think his biggest mistake as a diplomat?
I don't hear.
Okay. The question is, what was Ben-Gurion's biggest mistake as a diplomat, as a politician?
As a what?
As a diplomat, as a politician?
I don't understand the question.
Yes.
His worst mistake as a politician. It's a good question. He made a few mistakes. First of all, I think that his involvement in the Lebron scandal that ended his career was a big mistake from beginning to end. This is why I talked about a decade. He made mistakes before that decade. He made mistakes after that decade. I always think about when he should have retired. Should he have retired in 52 when he tried the first time to go to Sdebokir? This was the moment where the crisis in the life of the Jewish people that started, let's say, in 1933, more or less ended with the reparations agreement, with the absorption of the newcomers to Israel, the first mass immigration, etc., etc. Had he retired then, it would be at the top of his qualities. Then he came back, and then there was the Sinai campaign, which in retrospect, I think it's very important because it gave Israel 10 years of peace, that during that period, Israel absorbed really the newcomers. He should have retired in 57, or maybe he should have retired in 58, the 10th anniversary of Israel. Or maybe in 59, when he had the biggest electoral victory ever. Or maybe in 1960, when after he proclaimed from the Knesset that Eichmann was brought to Israel to stand in to trial. But he did not retire. He kept on. And he ended with a scandal that alienated his supporters. And he was pathetic, and really people got fed up with him. And this was, I think, his biggest mistake. He did not know when to say enough is enough. Okay. And maybe this is a good point to finish the lecture.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Państwu także dziękuję za uwagę. Wszystkich chciałem zachęcić do pobrania programów naszych wykładów. Za niecały miesiąc kolejny wykład o początkach państwa Izrael i wkładzie polskich Żydów w powstanie Izraela. A jeszcze w tym miesiącu będzie wykład naszej koleżanki Agnieszki Haskiej o pamięci zagłady w okresie komunistycznym, w Polsce komunistycznej. Ponownie w listopadzie wykład przygotowujący nas jak gdyby do 50. rocznicy wydarzeń marcowych wiosną przyszłego roku. Zapraszam do wzięcia, przy wyjściu mogą Państwo pobrać i do spoglądania na nasz program w ogóle w internecie. Dzieje się tutaj wiele ciekawych rzeczy. Raz jeszcze dziękuję za uwagę i dobranoc.